You're listening to Valley Edition. It's hard to imagine life in the San Joaquin Valley without the Sierra Nevada. While smog and dust often serves to obscure the view from the valley floor, this majestic mountain range plays a major role in our lives. It's not just home to internationally renowned gems like Yosemite, Sequoia, and Kings Canyon National Parks. It's also a place that's rich in its own human history. A new book seeks to share many of those moments. It's called Sierra Stories, Tales of Dreamers, Schemers, Bigots, and Rogues. And its author, Gary Noy of Sierra College in Rockland, joins us on Valley Edition right now. Gary, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
How did this book come about? These are short stories that you've compiled together of a variety of different people, different eras that all center in the Sierra Nevada. How did the idea come about?
Well, it came about really when it started when I was a little kid. I'm a Sierra Nevada kid. I was born in Grass Valley up in Nevada County. And ever since I was very little, I was always fascinated by the stories of the Sierra Nevada and in particular, the unusual, lesser-known stories. And part of that I owe to my parents, because they came to the Sierra, where they met and had me in Grass Valley, from elsewhere. My mom came from Oklahoma, and my dad was part of a gold mining family, a Cornish gold mining family from Montana. And so they were very interested in their new home. And so we traveled around all of the places there was. And ever since I was very little, I've always been fascinated by these kind of hidden corners and stories that were in the shadows.
And you touch upon many of them in this new book, ones that go all the way back to the Gold Rush era to the present day. I want to talk about some of the people. The subtitle of the book sort of piques one's interest, Dreamers, Schemers, Bigots, and Rogues. There's sort of an interesting sort of person that was drawn to the Sierra Nevada, was there not?
I think so. I think one of the primary themes in virtually all of the stories, and this book is only a handful of the thousands of stories that are out there, I think there's a kind of an overarching theme. And I think the people who came to the Sierra, most of them, came here to lose themselves, to lose their past in particular. People who came during the Gold Rush or in the years afterwards came for a new start, a rebirth, or a reinvention of their life. And so many of the stories reflect that, and I have the greatest respect for these folks who did this, because they were going to an unknown place, to an unknown fate. And these stories have always fascinated me, because basically that was my parents' story too. And so I think the stories reflect that kind of a basic theme.
One of the most colorful ones is that of Eliza Gilbert. Tell us about her.
Eliza Gilbert was an entertainer who clearly reinvented herself, because she was born in Europe, in Ireland, and reinvented herself as Lola Montez, as a Spanish aristocrat. And if you read her biography, she came from grinding poverty and then all of a sudden reinvented herself as the Spanish aristocrat who ultimately had a huge influence on European history. She became the mistress of Franz Liszt and King Ludwig I of Bavaria. And through her efforts and the scandal related to her, it ultimately led to the fall of the Bavarian monarchy and ushered in a whole series of revolutions in Europe that transformed the political structure in that world. And she was, in a way, she was kind of the scandalous figure of the time period, the Lindsay Lohan of the 1840s. And she ultimately escaped that, came to America as an entertainer who became famous or infamous for a kind of strange version of the tarantella dance that she called the spider dance, where she was being attacked by a legion of spiders. And she became kind of a figure of fun and derision, and ultimately moved to my hometown, which is Grass Valley, where she lived kind of in obscurity for a while and then kind of drifted off into history. But she's very typical of the kind of person who reinvented themselves and came to this part of the world, to the Sierra, to find a new start, a new way forward.
In the section, Just to Prove a Point, you write about the people who found these impossibly large trees, the giant sequoias, and then they cut them down so they could dance on the largest stump in the world. That's quite a window into the mindset of the person who came to the Sierra as well, is it not?
I think so. I think it's a very typical 19th century viewpoint. in particular, that people came to this part of the world to experience a brand new landscape. And yet, in the mid-19th century in particular, there was a belief that humans could conquer nature. And so they took this giant sequoia, this is in the Calaveras Big Trees, and they took 3 weeks to cut it down just to prove that they could, and then they polished off the stump and made it into a dance floor. And John Muir famously wrote about this in his 1901 book, Our National Parks, in which he decried this desecration of this beautiful organism. And then the fallen part of the tree, they turned into a bowling alley and into a kind of an observatory office that they put a building over the part of the stump. They had a part of the fallen tree that they put a ladder up, and you could pay a nickel or a few cents to climb up to the top of this fallen monarch. And it became kind of a symbol of the exploitation and viewpoint toward nature that was rampant during the mid-19th century and which I believe is gone now, thankfully.
Race factors into a number of the stories that you tell as well, from the story of the Japanese internment in Manzanar to the Chinese exclusion laws to African-American soldiers in Yosemite. Tell me a little more about how you see race as an issue in the Sierra throughout the centuries.
Well, I think it's part of the entire collective historical journey that we've gone through to get to this a particular moment in time. And sometimes the road is smooth and level and beautiful, and sometimes it's very, very steep and rough and terrible and horrifying, and it's all part of the experience. And sadly, in Sierra Nevada history, the most hidden aspects of our history have to do with race relations. So to understand the context and the texture and the nuance of our Sierra experience, you have to talk about the darker, very troubling episodes. And so I address those in the book, and I think it helps us understand the journey that we've gone through to this point. It's a troubling history, but we've come a long, long way from those days. And even in the darkest moments, there were rays of light in which people demonstrated kindness toward each other, or remarkable stories came out of it, such as with the Japanese Americans. The development of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team of Japanese-American volunteers from the camps, who became the most decorated military unit of its size and duration of service in the history of the United States Army, in the history of military service in the United States. An extraordinary story. And so I think, you know, it factors in importantly in helping us understand how we've gotten to this point in time. I think it's part of the journey.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, we're talking today to author Gary Noy. He is the author of a new book called Sierra Stories, Tales of Dreamers, Schemers, Bigots, and Rogues. It's brand new, and you can find it on Heyday Books. We're talking about these often forgotten or overlooked elements of our history in California in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Tell me about some of the stories that you found the most interesting to research from a historian's perspective.
Oh, gosh, how long do we have? all of them are just fascinating to me. And the book has 64 stories, but it could have easily have been a couple of hundred or thousand, because every city, every county, every family, every person has a story, and it's just fascinating to do this. Let me relate this one story, because it's really the catalyst of my interest in all of this. And that's... It was really the first one that I researched in any depth, and this was just when I was a kid. When I grew up in Grass Valley, there was a little street around the corner from where I lived, literally around the corner, called Kate Hayes Street. And it was a little alley, dark little alley, that led up toward the Empire Mine. And I didn't know who Kate Hayes was. It was just a name to me until I got a little bit older and I did some research. And I found out that she was a famous, world-famous Irish operatic diva during the gold rush, and a favorite of the miners. And she was such a favorite that throughout the Sierra, there were locations that were named for her, Kate Hayes Flat. There was a Kate Hayes Mining Company, and even little streets like in Grass Valley that led up to the Empire Mine. And as I researched it more, I found out that she sang for Queen Victoria, that she's considered essentially the mother of show business in Australia. There's a hospital that's still functional in Australia today that's named after her, called Catherine Hayes Hospital. A very famous figure. And yet, it was hidden in this street sign. And through the research, I was able to find out about it. And through the decades that I've been collecting these stories, this kind of pattern has happened time and time and time again, where something sparks my interest, and I'll go do the research and find these nuggets just waiting for us under our nose.
Speaking of those sorts of nuggets, Dr. Otto Eshe brought in two Bactrian camels from Asia. Tell me about him. Why did he undertake such a endeavor?
Well, it's a curious connection with someone from down in the San Joaquin Valley, essentially. There was a general named Edward Fitzgerald Beale, and during the Civil War, he was a grand promoter of using camels in the Western Desert as a form of military transport. And General Beale established the Camel Corps, a very short-lived experiment in camels, part of which was headquartered in Fort Tejon, down near Bakersfield. And following that experiment, others tried it as a commercial experience. And Otto Eshe was one of these. And he brought in these Bactrian camels, two hump camels, to transport goods essentially from the valley to the mines in Nevada and back. And it was a short-lived experience. There is a famous image that's actually in the book showing this caravan of camels going through the Calaveras big trees right by the Discovery Tree stump, the one where they had the dance. And it was a short-lived experience that led to, ultimately, these camels, some of them were released out in the Nevada desert because it just didn't work, that led to the fact that at one point in the 1870s, there were so many camels in Nevada that the state of Nevada passed a piece of legislation forbidding camels to be utilized on state thoroughfares. And so it was it's a remarkable story, part of this kind of quirky legacy that we have from the Sierra Nevada.
There's the quirky legacy. There's also a very rich engineering legacy. You talk about it in several instances, from Theodore Judah and the Truckee Incline to Tioga Pass Road. Tell me about the amazing engineering feats that you document in this book.
Well, it's the Tioga Pass Road is just a rollicking adventure because it's essentially the story deals with the eastern end leading down toward Lee Vining, and how it came to be known as the Terrible Tioga because it was so rough and so dangerous that even to this day, that part of the pass, the Yosemite National Park recommends that you not even hike there, but yet there's a road there, and it's much safer and nicer today. But in the beginning, it was very, very dangerous. And another story that a number of people have commented on to me is the story of Andrew Hallady, and who was the father of the cable car system in San Francisco, but had his start building suspension bridges during the Gold Rush period, sprinkled throughout the gold country in the Sierra. And it was there that he experimented with what he called wire rope, what we call metal cable today, which becomes the basis for a continuous loop for a ski lift or for the cable cars. And so there is an influential legacy in terms of engineering, in terms of the railroad and mining techniques and things like Halliday's ropeway, as he called it, that still influence us today.
I want to close with one of the more contemporary stories. You talk about some of the pioneering mountain climbers, free climbers, and others in Yosemite National Park, even in recent times. Do you see some commonalities between them today and their predecessors years ago, pioneers in the Sierra over 150 years ago?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I think it's all part of the same continuum. I mean, if you look at the stories, if you go back to, for instance, George Anderson, who's considered to be the first human to scale Half Dome, all the way up to Alex Honnold today, who's kind of the contemporary rock star, as they call him in some newspapers, of climbing. They all have the same kind of adventurous spirit, this kind of go for broke, putting aside their own personal safety in order to accomplish extraordinary goals. And they all use the same kind of equipment that has, through time, transformed and improved to the degree where, You know, we look at the very sophisticated climbing equipment today compared to the hobnailed boots that John Muir wore, for instance, and we think they're different, but it's just kind of a continuum based upon the same basic concept, which is just start climbing, hang on, and hope. And it's reflected in the spirit of these climbers today that I think is just a continuous thread all through our history in the Sierra.
Again, our guest today is Gary Noy. He is the author of the new book, Sierra Stories, Tales of Dreamers, Schemers, Bigots, and Rogues. It's available on Heyday Books, wherever better books are sold. Mr. Noy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.